is this Jesus who was sent by God the Father? Who is this Jesus who sends out his followers and disciples into the world? And what ministry and mission did Jesus have that helps us understand our ministry and mission in the world? Last week, we looked at the theme of Jesus as the bridegroom, Jesus as the groom, which is a theme I've not really preached on before or thought about before. I was thankful I had a chance to do that. And I was trying to suggest last week that if we want to hear the message of Jesus as the bridegroom, we have to distance ourselves from how most of us think about bridegrooms, right? We have to go back as much as we can in the first century Jewish culture and think, what did they hear when Jesus presents himself as the bridegroom? One of the things that happened last week's Sunday, as we looked at that story, Jesus turning water into wine, was he took people who were about to be shamed because the wine was about to run out or had run out. So a whole lot of shame was going to be piled on this groom and his bride and on their families. And he took that shame and he supplied all this wine and gave them this great amount of honor. And we also, interestingly, saw the same theme in the video we watched, right? That young boy or that young man in the pig pen. Now, some of us might think, oh, pig pen, not very nice, smelly. But for a Jewish person, being in a pig pen with an unclean animal or animals wanting to eat the food of an unclean animal was, you know, shame par excellence. Like, who can think of something more shameful than to be in the pen of a pig eating the food of a pig? So I find it interesting, John 2, but now also the story from Luke 15, Jesus moving people from shame to honor. And this morning, Jesus moving someone from darkness to light. So Genevieve, if you would read from Genesis 1. And John 2 and 3.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. All you see, all you don't see. Earth was a soup of nothingness, a bottomless emptiness, an inky blackness. God's spirit brooded like a bird above the watery abyss. God spoke, light. And light appeared. God saw that light was good and separated light from dark. God named the light day. He named the dark night. It was evening. It was morning. Day one. And this is from John 2, verse 23. During the time he was in Jerusalem, those days of the Passover feast, many people noticed the signs he was displaying, and seeing they pointed straight to God, entrusted their lives to him. But Jesus didn't entrust his life to them. He knew them inside and out, knew how untrustworthy they were. He didn't need any help in seeing right through them. And going on to chapter 3, there was a man of the Pharisee sect, Nicodemus, a prominent leader among the Jews. Late one night, he visited Jesus and said, "Rabbi, we all know you're a teacher straight from God. No one could do all the God-pointing, God-revealing acts you do if God weren't in on it." Jesus said, "You're absolutely right. Take it from me. Unless a person is born from above, it's not possible to see what I'm pointing to God's kingdom." "How can anyone," said Nicodemus, "be born who has already been born and grown up? You can't re-enter your mother's womb and be born again. What are you saying with this born from above talk?" Jesus said, "You're not listening. Let me say it again. Unless a person submits to this original creation, the wind hovering over the water creation, the invisible moving the visible, a baptism into new life, it's not possible to enter God's kingdom. When you look at a baby, it's just that, a body you can look at and touch. But the person who takes shape within is formed by something you can't see and touch, the spirit, and becomes a living spirit. So don't be surprised when I tell you that you have to be born from above, out of this world, so to speak. You know well enough how the wind blows this way and that. You hear it rustling through the trees, but you have no idea where it comes from or where it's headed next. That's the way it is with everyone born from above, by the wind of God, the Spirit of God. Nicodemus asked, "What do you mean by this? How does this happen?" Jesus said, "You're a respected teacher of Israel, and you don't know these basics? Listen carefully. I'm speaking sober truth to you. I speak only what I know by experience. I give witness only to what I have seen with my own eyes. There's nothing secondhand here, no hearsay. Yet, instead of facing the evidence and accepting it, you procrastinate with questions. If I tell you things that are as plain as the hand before your face and you don't believe me, what use is there in telling you of things you can't see, the things of God? No one has ever gone up into the presence of God except the one who came down from that presence, the Son of Man. In the same way that Moses lifted the serpent in the desert so people could have something to see and then believe, it is necessary for the Son of Man to be lifted up, and everyone who looks up to him, trusting and expectant, will gain a real life, eternal life." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. That was a great reading, I thought. I hope you think so too. NIV is great, ESV is great, but the message, you know, it's also, it's a bit of a paraphrase, but it helps me understand the passage even more. This morning, I want to just follow the conversation, the flow of the conversation between Jesus and Nicodemus, or on the slides, it'll be Jesus and Nico, because I couldn't fit Nicodemus on the slide, his full name. So, I want us to just kind of go very quickly over this conversation that John Viev just read for us from John chapter 3. I want to point a few things out. I want to begin just by recognizing that most people in the first century, when they would have heard a Pharisee is going to meet Jesus, they would have thought, great, wonderful, a nice religious man, a leader in our community is going to meet with Jesus. This is going to be a great conversation. I just say that because most people in the modern church, they hear the word Pharisee, they think bad guy. We can't trust this person. But not people in that first century. They would have thought, oh, this is a nice person, good religious leader. So the setup to the conversation that people would hear is much different than what we hear. But Nicodemus, as he begins talking to Jesus, basically says a compliment. That's how I take it, right? You are from God. You're a rabbi from God. We can easily see that. You're a teacher who's come from God. And this is how we would maybe all want to be addressed when we're in conversation with someone. Like if after the service I'm talking to Herman and I say, "Herman, that was a great set of songs you put together for us today. Thank you so much." Most of us would like to have that a conversation start that way. But most of us also would, you know, if I say, "Oh, Herman, that was a great set of songs you picked for us today. Thank you for leading us." We expect Herman to say, "Thank you. Wonderful. I'm feeling good. You want to join my worship team next time that I lead?" So here comes a compliment. Jesus, you're a teacher from God. And we expect Jesus to say, "Thank you." At least you see what I am. Why don't you become one of my disciples? But Jesus, like he almost always does, he doesn't respond how we expect or how I would respond to Nicodemus. He says, you must be born from above. So I'm not even going to pick up your compliments, really. I'm not going to say thank you or great or why don't you join me. I have my own agenda that I want to talk to you about. And I'm thankful in the message it was the translation born from above, not the typical born again, because I think the born from above translation is the better translation. Thank you. If you have the NIV, the NIV does note at the bottom of the page that this word for again or from above is the same word. You can translate it either way. So I think Jesus is actually telling Nicodemus, you must be born from God. You must be born from above. Something of God's Spirit has to happen in you. And the imagery in the Bible is this comes from above us and it comes down to us. Nicodemus, in response to this teaching, you know, a little different than I was expecting, Jesus. But when he hears the word, I think he thinks, not from above, but born again. How is this possible? How is it possible that someone be born again? That's actually not possible. That's impossible. This is very strange talk, Jesus. You're a strange teacher. And Jesus, again, doesn't say, okay, it is pretty strange. Let me work it out for you. In verse 7, he says, you shouldn't be surprised that I'm talking like this because you called me a rabbi, but you are also a rabbi. You are also a teacher. You should know better. Through your reading of the Hebrew Scriptures, you should know that nobody is able to be fully human by simply being flesh and blood. Right? From the earliest pages of the Bible, we heard that or read that God had to breathe his breath, his life, his spirit into people to make them come alive. And throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, we hear about the Spirit coming on people. So you shouldn't be surprised that I'm telling you have to be born from above or born by the Spirit or born of God. And again, Nicodemus in verse 9 is saying, how is this possible? What is going on? I'm not tracking with you, Jesus, at all. This is not just tough. This is crazy talk. And Jesus, again, in verse 10 says, you are Israel's teacher. You should know about this. I'm talking to you elementary level information. You're supposed to be graduate level teacher, but you can't understand. It's almost, I think, like a rebuke or a correction at Nicodemus. Now, this is how I read the conversation. I read it as a stilted, not very natural, not your typical conversation between two people. I read it as a what I would call a maneuvered conversation by Jesus. And if that's true, I want to ask, why is that happening? Why does Jesus talk this way with Nicodemus, who starts so complimentary? And I want to suggest, as I've already hinted at, this is what Jesus does. In conversations with people, this is how Jesus talks. Because people always bring their agenda to Jesus. I want to talk about this. And I want to talk at this level or this level. And Jesus is always on his own agenda. But I also suggest, and that's why I asked Genevieve to start reading in chapter 2, I also suggest that Jesus is a little apprehensive of Nicodemus. And I sense that in the conversation. He doesn't give himself to Nicodemus in conversation. He doesn't follow Nicodemus's lead. Nicodemus wants to go in a certain direction, but Jesus is weary of Nicodemus. At the end of chapter 2, this is from the NIV this morning, we hear these words. Now, while Jesus was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, Many people saw signs he was performing and believed in his name. Which, if you're reading the Bible, you think, oh, that's wonderful. People believe in the name of Jesus. We should be rejoicing. Jesus should be rejoicing. But then we read, somewhat strangely, but Jesus would not entrust himself to them. It's the same word as the word believed. So people are believing in Jesus, but Jesus is not believing in people. Because he knew all people. He knew what was in each person. He knows what's in Nicodemus. And those words from chapter 2 move right into the conversation between Nicodemus and Jesus. Jesus knows that Nicodemus might want to flatter him with his compliments. He might want to just simply stay on a certain kind of level, just on the surface. He knows that Nicodemus has his own agenda, and Jesus, somewhat stiltingly, moves the conversation in another direction. But I'm also going to suggest this morning that as we read the conversation between Jesus and Nicodemus, Jesus knows that Nicodemus is in the dark, right? He's in the darkness. That's how the chapter begins. Chapter 3, verse 1, we read that there was a Pharisee. Now, again, original readers would have heard, oh, a good guy, a nice guy, a great guy. His name was Nicodemus, which means conqueror of the people. He was a kind of leader. He was a member of the Jewish ruling council. So all these kind of accolades about who Nicodemus is has set him up. He came to Jesus at night. And I think John is not simply telling us it was dark outside. I think John is trying to tell us it was dark inside. It was dark inside Nicodemus' mind or his heart. And I suggest that because he does the same thing John does in chapter 13. He's telling the story about the Last Supper, Jesus and his disciples. Jesus knows what's going to happen. He knows the suffering's coming, the cross is coming. He also knows the betrayal is coming. That one of these 12 friends is going to sell him for 30 pieces of silver. So his life is worth 30 pieces of silver. And to his betrayer, Judas, he gives a piece of bread. And then the writer says, as soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out. And it was night. And I suggest in both of these instances, John is not just telling us detail about the outside. He's trying to tell us detail about the inside. That Judas goes into a spiritual darkness, and Nicodemus is talking out of some kind of spiritual darkness. He doesn't understand Jesus, doesn't understand his teaching. Now, if this was the only story in the Gospel of John that featured Nicodemus, I would be feeling a little depressed this morning. I would also be feeling a little bit sort of off kilter, because this is very unusual for John, if he just told us this story about Nicodemus, to kind of leave him in the dark. Almost every character in the Gospel of John who meets Jesus is always on some kind of journey somewhere better. So Nicodemus, in this chapter, he doesn't get a really great look, right? I mean, he doesn't understand Jesus. Jesus is trying to correct him. I think in some ways rebuke him. He's supposed to be this great teacher. Doesn't understand about being born from above. And John doesn't leave it there. This is one of the amazing things about this gospel writer. He doesn't leave Nicodemus in the dark. So if we keep reading the gospel, I'm going to point out two other places where Nicodemus is mentioned. A second place is chapter 7, where in this chapter, the religious leaders are getting together and they're kind of condemning who Jesus is, all that Jesus teaches. The religious leaders are telling people, don't believe in Jesus. And Nicodemus, who's there, he's part of the ruling council, kind of stands up for Jesus. It's not a full defense. He doesn't say, Jesus is the Messiah, but he says, does our law condemn a man without first hearing him out and finding out what he's doing? So I'm going to suggest he's not saying, I'm a disciple, I'm a follower, I believe in Jesus. I'm going to say he's in the half lights. He was in the darkness, but now in front of others, he's willing at least to say we have to at least listen to Jesus and give him a fair hearing. And then as we keep reading the Gospel of John, I find it amazing at the very end of the Gospel of John, chapter 19, Nicodemus is there at the crucifixion. Now, I never really picked that up. I always thought, who's at the crucifixion? Well, there's Mary, and probably another Mary, and there's John, and I would love to know if Peter's at the crucifixion. We're not sure exactly. And of course, there are hecklers and leaders making sure he dies and yelling at him, insulting him, jeering him, spitting on him. And who else is here? Well, Nicodemus. Nicodemus is at the cross. He's not jeering. He's not spitting. He's not gawking. He's not shaking his fist at Jesus. I find this really amazing. Later, this is John 19:38, Joseph of Arimathea, who's a fairly wealthy man, asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he feared the Jewish leaders. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who earlier had visited Jesus at night. So that's what he used to be. He used to be someone under the cover of night. I'm scared of what people will say. I'm also dark on the inside, and I'm coming to talk to Jesus. I have no idea. There's like a wall. I can't understand him. But now he is in the afternoon, in the light, no longer sneaking around at night to meet Jesus. He brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds. And I read, and I'm just taking it for face value at this point, unless someone tells me otherwise, one blog post said this was about $150,000 worth of spices. And I'm just blown away by this man who doesn't understand. Then a little while later, well, at least let's listen to him. Let's give him a fair hearing. And then at the moment of Jesus' death, is there with extravagant gift, $150,000 for a dead body. Who does that? Well, I want to suggest it's someone who is following, listening to, respecting, I think also disciple, but families do this. Family members take down bodies or carry bodies or hold bodies when they die. And Nicodemus is right there taking down the body of Jesus from the cross, wrapping the body. $150,000 worth of spices on the body to keep it from smelling bad. And I suggest that when he's at the cross, which is sort of a wonderful and amazing moment, it's at the moment of Jesus' death that Nicodemus comes into the full lights. And I found this sculpture, this picture of the sculpture. It's supposedly from a church in Vienna, It makes me kind of think about the scene, like what would have been like for Nicodemus to take down, if we can just go back to the previous one, the previous slide. Yeah. What would have been like to take down the body of Jesus? Roman soldiers watching, maybe hecklers watching, people looking at you. Humbling experience, you're getting dirty, and you're getting, I assume, the blood of Jesus on your clothes. So I am so thankful that the gospel writer doesn't leave Nicodemus in the dark. Right? There's more to the story, and he's on a journey that I know others of us can attest to. Right? The darkness in our lives when we're thinking about Jesus is sometimes ignorance of who he is or ignorance of what he taught or being ashamed of him, hiding in the corner, not seeing Jesus for who he truly is. And then we come out of the darkness and we come into the half-lights. Like, I think I see. At least we should listen to him. And then maybe we come into the full light, where I'm not ashamed to hold his dead body. I'm not ashamed to wrap his dead body. The most wonderful thing about this character in the Gospel of John is not so much what he goes through. Well, that's wonderful. I call it a kind of transformation. I call it a journey or a conversion. But the most wonderful thing is that this is what Jesus does. This is what Jesus longs to do with us, to take us out of darkness and bring us into light. And I'm thankful this morning as well that we get a chance to move from the message into this table here. Communion, or we call it the Lord's table or the Lord's Supper. It's a moment for us to recognize, and the way that I'll say it this morning is, we are not the light. Right? We are not the light. We sometimes think we're the light, or we sometimes think we have it all together, and then we come in contact with Jesus and we realize, no, he is the light. And in me, there's lots of darkness. And I need to come to him. I need to come to Jesus Christ, who is the light for the world, but also the light for me.